We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
On today's episode of BuzzBeat, we discuss the postponement of the Hornets games, get to some of our listener questions, and talk about Terry Rozier's value. All of that plus more up next.
Blue Wire.
With the third pick in the 2020 NBA Draft, the Charlotte Hornets select LaMelo Ball from Chino Hills, California.
TJ, oh my goodness! Stunning with the left hand! Devontae deep! Oh my goodness! I don't believe it! A 30-footer to Graham!
Just stop it already!
All right, what's up everyone, and welcome to another Buzz Beat. This is Richie, and I'm joined by Brian today. BG, what's going on? How's it going?
I'm doing all right, man. How about yourself?
Doing pretty good. A little bit exhausted. I got my iced latte here to kind of pick me up. But how's your Twin Peaks viewing coming along?
Twin Peaks is going well, man. I'm in the middle of season two right now, so I've watched a few episodes since we recorded last week with Div and with Spencer. And yeah, it's like, it's a bit of a slow burn, but I like that. I like shows that are a slow burn, and it is legitimately scary, but obviously it's funny. It's clever. I really like it. It's the only non-basketball thing I have in my life right now, so I'm sort of cherishing it at the moment as well.
Now, when you say scary, I didn't realize it was scary. I knew it was kind of like freaky, but it actually does it have some like jump scares in it or not necessarily?
I think maybe not like jump. I mean, yeah, there's some stuff that is pretty alarming, I would say. Now it's sort of like those, I don't know, they could be quantified as like, I guess, freakier than scary. But I think the response I'm feeling is, yeah, it's a mixture of terror and creepiness, and Lynch is sort of David Lynch is sort of a master of that. So it's really great. I really like it. And maybe it's not for everyone, but I am definitely mowing through it and really enjoying it. Also, this is not a reason to like or dislike the show or whatever, but one of the best intros for a TV show. when you watch The Wire, do you watch the whole intro or do you skip through the intro?
Oh gosh, I'm afraid to answer this question. I actually skip that intro.
Yeah, so I probably do now, but maybe on the first couple times going through it, I watched it. Then the song, it's the same song. They change it up during certain seasons, you know? And I think there are some other shows that have really good intros, but Twin Peaks is like in the conversation for a strong intro that even while you're binging, it is worth the like additional 30 to 45 seconds to like watch the full intro.
I do that with Friday Night Lights. That gets me pumped for that show. Just the intro and Friday Night Lights as well. So the one show that I've been watching or just finished was a documentary on Netflix. It was called The Disappearance at the Cecil Hotel. And I don't know if you've heard of the case, the Alyssa Lamb case. And basically, it's an interesting case. Like, I'm not going to spoil the show, but basically, she books a room in this hotel, and the last known footage of her is in the elevator, and she's just acting very strange. She's pushing all the buttons. The doors are not closing, and it looks like she's peeking around the corner down the hallway, like she's talking to someone or someone's approaching her. And the whole time that you see this video, the doors are not closing for whatever reason. And then she finally exits the elevator door. And I don't know, moments later, the door closes. And that's like the last known footage we have of this girl. And there's a lot of theories.
Jeez Louise.
Yeah, it's kind of freaky. And because she's acting very strange. And I think she does have like bipolar disorder. So like it could be like an episode that she's having. And who knows if she's actually talking to someone or not. But yeah, they kind of go through the case and all the wild parallels that are going on. And there's a lot of theories that are thrown around. I think a lot of people don't like the show because it's, without spoiling it, there's way more theories, obviously, that are just kind of crazy and out there. And it almost leads you to believe that it's going to be true. But then they kind of disprove the theory at the end of them all. So,
gotcha. Okay. Interesting.
And it's very only four episodes. Only four episodes. So you can watch it in, you know, a couple of nights. So. All right, before we get into the Hornets here, BG, I don't get to watch much college basketball, and you write for accsports.com, so I'm going to give you some quick hitter questions before we get into some Hornets talk.
All right,
let's limit this to two prospects within the ACC. Give me two prospects that will or should be high on NBA draft boards for 2021, and who would those be in your mind?
Yeah, this is not like a great year, I think, for draft prospects out of the ACC, but it's certainly not bad. And there's plenty compelling names at the top. One of whom has been generating plenty of buzz this week. Most of that noise coming simply just from the media, really amplifying it, running with it in a variety of different ways. But yeah, formerly of Duke, Jalen Johnson. Jalen's a guy that should go in the lottery, that could be inside the top 10. At times, he has looked like, you know, the fifth or the sixth or the seventh best prospect in this draft. I don't know if he'll go quite that high, but I wouldn't be surprised to see him be drafted that high. I think if the Hornets landed late lottery, there's a chance he's the guy they'd have to, that they would consider strictly from just like a talent play. What Jalen does well is really impactful. And when he's at his best, some of the stuff he does well is like really special, and you can see it translating to the NBA, but there's a variety of knocks on him right now. Offensively, doesn't have much of a jump shot at times. You know, he looks fine, sort of like just catching and shooting, but no real like threatening perimeter jump shot right now. He is very athletic, you know, 6'9", 220 pounds, got that great sort of like rangy basketball body, and a pretty explosive vertical athlete when he has some runway, you know, so when he's able to get a few steps to gather a little bit of steam, Vinny can really explode, but I'm not sure if he's just like a 2 foot, you know, rise up jumper, an amazing second leaper. Again, he is an explosive athlete, but I think he's just far more explosive when he's able to, you know, ramp up and pick up a little momentum or steam and then really explode. His half court decision-making is not great. Doesn't always make great passes. Occasionally can really like can play make out of the post, can look opposite, can see cutters, can see shooters. Occasionally has these little bursts of feel where he cuts through and is able to like advance the ball to another teammate with a little touch pass. That's really, really nice. Like has some secondary creator connector aspects to his game that are interesting, but the decision-making I think comes and goes, and those issues can be exaggerated by his lack of like side to side burst, beating his own guy man to man. Johnson's pretty strong. And if you go back and watch the Illinois game, I mean, you can see him, you know, displacing Kofi Coburn and sort of moving that guy on some of those drives. But at the same time, teams like Illinois or teams like Michigan State have been able to get away with putting their centers on him. And Johnson, even with a space court, isn't able to like beat those guys left or right off the dribble. And they're able to sag off of him because of the lack of a jump shot. So there are some interesting there's some pros and cons to how Johnson projects right now as like a half court creator and a connector. He's far better in the open court That's really where I sort of liked him a lot this season, was grab and goes, his ability to run. That's when I think you see the best of him as a finisher. That's where you see the best of him as a playmaker. And that's really where I think he is at his most comfortable and most explosive self, at least for now. Defensively, really struggles to get into a stance and guard the ball one-on-one, regardless of like what position he's matched up against. Like, seems unable to get in a stance on some possessions. And as far as like pick and roll defense goes, like he has shown some versatility, some switchability. He's got this great body. You know, it looks like he should be able to guard all five positions, but like as a drop defender, or when Duke's asked him to ice ball screens, like just total like hit or miss. Like sometimes is in an awful position, you know, starts the possession off from the wrong angle, doesn't have his hands in a good location, isn't ready to adjust versus a pop or a roll or a slip. You see, I just rewatched the Duke Clemson game this morning, and like, I mean, he played great offensively in that game, but Clemson, like their ball screen offense just shredded him. And I don't know if he'll be involved in a lot of like, you know, straight pick and roll in the NBA. You know, if he's playing the four, he'll be more of like a backline help defender, switch guy in the perimeter. You know what I mean? But it's something to consider. So I like Johnson as a prospect. I'm not in love with him. I don't think what happened at Duke is going to ultimately, like, as far as like him, you know, declaring for the draft, I don't think that's going to hurt his stock too much either way. I hope it doesn't. Like, this season was weird. I wish it had gone better. I wish it had been a roaring success for both Jalen Johnson and Duke, and stuff just never was right from the middle of December until now. But hey, hopefully it's just the start of things for Jalen basketball wise. And then the other guy, and I'll try to speed this up, is Scotty Barnes from Florida State, who's a guy that, like, yeah, I could see him, you know, I don't know, we'll see. Maybe come workout season, because he's such a specimen. Maybe he'll move up some on boards. But I love Scotty Barnes, despite the fact that he's a non-shooter right now. Huge. Florida State's huge playmaker, like a jumbo playmaker. Similarly in that 6'9", you know, 220-pound range. FSU's playing him at point guard right now. I don't see him as a point guard for the moment. I think he's a, you know, power forward. I think he's a secondary creator, a secondary ball handler, a guy that can connect possessions, that can pass from a variety of different places, can be very dangerous in the open court. He has some moments passing out of the pick and roll that will blow your minds, because he's so big. He'll turn the corner and he'll just whip the ball to the opposite side just perfectly. But because he's such a liability shooting the ball and shooting off the dribble right now, I don't think like NBA defenses are going to just cave and give him those angles. And they're going to make that a lot more difficult than it is for him right now in college. But Scotty's whole game is built on feel, which I think he has good feel, is built on passing, which I just mentioned, and is built on some combination of like leadership and his ability to be like a communicator, right? And that's why FSU is a great spot for him, because like he fits right into the culture right there. Like immediately, FSU's had him coming off the bench some the second half of the season, no issues, plays with great spirit. Every game comes in, defends whatever position, because FSU switches 1 through 5. Defensively, Barnes, his steals numbers are great. Blocks some shots every now and then. I don't love him as sort of like a one-on-one defender, but I think he can get better. Oftentimes you just see him, it's just like, yeah, he doesn't get in stance and guys can just zippy or guys drive by him. But as a team defender, he can be a pest on digs, on steals, looking for interceptions. And then as soon as he launches transition, he can be really dangerous. But Barnes has got to become a better shooter. But I love a lot of what he brings to the table. I don't know if he's like a great fit for the Hornets necessarily, because, you know, he's a pass first guy and a bit of a non-shooter, and they have PJ at the four and blah, blah, blah. Whether that should sway any of these decisions or not, I'm not sure if either Johnson or Barnes are like perfectly clean fits with what Charlotte has right now, just due to their positions and the lack of a reliable 3-point jumper at the moment. But I like them both as prospects. I think I would give both of them, you know, lottery grades. And I would say Johnson is a better prospect than Barnes overall. And those are like unquestionably the top two guys out of the ACC. And then just one other name to mention is David Johnson. He's a sophomore, like combo guard at Louisville. Functional handles, not great handles, but is a big guard, 6'5", jump shot got a lot better this season, added a post game this season. I think has been an improved team defender. We just like to see more of him. Like Louisville hasn't played in over 2 weeks due to COVID concerns, but he's big. He can really pass. And he's gotten better as a team, both team defender and as like an isolation post scorer too. And I think Johnson's a guy that I feel very comfortable saying he's a, you know, top 20 to top 25 prospect in this draft and would be a nice add for teams that are sort of like looking for another. I don't know if he's a true one. Like, I think he might be more of a combo guard. Mm-hmm. And luckily, like, his strides as a jump shooter, I mean, he's really turned into a knockdown, three-point shooter this season with an elevated three-point attempt rate, probably are favorable for him. So that, along with the improvements as a team defender, I think make him like sort of like a nice copy and paste guy, potentially as mid to late first round prospects. So there's plenty of other guys to name, but let's just stick with those three guys for right now. Jalen Johnson, Scotty Barnes, and David Johnson.
A couple of Johnsons and some Barnes there. Yeah. So that was very informative.
Right.
It's crazy to think that the draft is probably closer than we actually are like envisioning. I can't believe it's already mid-February when you think about it.
Yeah. And just a side note, Richie, it's nuts too, because the 2020 draft was 3 months ago.
Right.
You know,
right.
Like, it's the calendar is just so wonky right now.
Well, let's get to some breaking news concerning the Hornets. It has been revealed that multiple Spurs have tested positive for COVID. And as a result, the Spurs are going to be missing their next three games. In this same media release, we found out because the Hornets played the Spurs on Sunday that Charlotte will also miss their next two games against the Bulls and the Nuggets in order to ensure, as they call it, health and safety of both of these teams. I'm not sure this is like good news by any means, but as someone mentioned in our Slack today, that there could be a silver lining in terms of helping with the recovery of some of our injured players, assuming they didn't come in contact with COVID. Devontae Graham left the game on Sunday early with a knee injury, and then Gordon Hayward didn't play at all because he was dealing with some issues with his back. So the next time that the Hornets are supposed to play is on Saturday versus the Warriors. So their next two games this week are off. Brian, any implications of this? I mean, or is it just, you know, this is just what we have to expect with the NBA season? COVID is challenging because if I'm correct, you can actually test negative but still be contagious. Like someone could test negative today, positive tomorrow, but they could have had it in their system. Like, it doesn't show up right away on some of these tests. That's what makes COVID so challenging, because you don't know that you have it sometimes, or you're not showing symptoms, but you could actually be contagious.
You 100%. I mean, like, yeah, that's of the many things that have made this virus just so damning and brutal to deal with is what you just referenced. That it is just like you can have it and not know. There are delays on with some of these tests to know when you're going to get a result. Like, there are just so many different like loops in this entire process that really complicate what is already like on face value just a very scary disease, because it is deadly to a certain up to a certain percentage of the population. Mm-hmm. And even today, Jason Tatum of the Boston Celtics came out and said during his media availability, as you know, Tatum, who's having a great season, but Tatum had COVID. And he said, like, yes, sort of like anecdotally, but like, yeah, I think he was, I'm paraphrasing Jason Tatum, but he said, yes, I've felt it. I felt winded at times going up and down so much this season. And maybe that's, you know, maybe that has impacted his play somehow. He's been pretty damn good, honestly. But that's scary. Like, we still don't know all of the, like, you know, intermediate, you know, short-term, intermediate, and long-term impacts health-wise of COVID. And even how it relates to high-performance athlete, young, you know, high-performance athletes like Jason Tatum. We saw how this impacted guys down in the bubble, what feels like a lifetime ago. It's scary for so many different reasons and is worrisome. But, you know, it was only a matter of time before the Hornets had right. their schedule impacted by this again. It's just, it's not possible to avoid it. It just isn't. I can't tell you, just covering the ACC this year, I can't tell you how many times I've had to write stories about games getting postponed, and we've seen all of that play out in the NBA too. So it's really unfortunate for the four Spurs that did test positive. That was according to Woj's reporting. You know, hopefully everyone on Charlotte is able to stay healthy. I think the Spurs were still in Charlotte as of today.
Correct.
As of when this report broke. But I even saw Terry Rozier on Twitter tweeting out saying, like, yeah, it just gives us more rest, which, you know, I'm not even sure that's like the right or wrong read of the situation ultimately, you know, right. but to the point that you brought up at the start, like, yeah, they had some injuries. They had some guys already in the protocol with the Martin twins and PJ who weren't able to play against what Minnesota last week. And then also in the Brooklyn or pardon me, the San Antonio game. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the Devontae was hurt in that game. And then, you know, Gordon Hayward didn't play because of back injury. Yeah. Is that what it was?
Yeah. Carrying the team on his back.
Yeah. at times he has been this year. But yeah, I don't know. What was your read on the situation when that news broke today?
I kind of wasn't surprised. I don't know. I mean, I think it was eventually going to affect the Hornets at some point. I think, like, if you have a silver lining, it could be the fact that they are resting up and they can get some players that are injured back, in the lineup and playing, but that might not be the right way to look at it. Like you're saying, Brian, like that there's something bigger here going on.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Transitioning to like the All-Star game, like, correct me if I'm wrong, when we went into this season, there was no plan of an All-Star game, correct?
I thought that was part of it. That was like, maybe they didn't come out and say like no All-Star game, but it was like at the least implied. I thought that this is like probably not going to happen. They built in this like
break,
you know, 5-6 day period or whatever that would allow them to sort of sort things out, make sure stuff was lined up for the second half of the season. But yeah, I thought that's what it was for. It was for like rest and a reset, as opposed to that. Plus also let's like squeeze in like a couple more, you know, money-making events in here.
Yeah. I mean, so they're trying to get the All-Star game in, and they're also trying to get like the dunk contest and 3-point contest and the skills contest. And I just think this whole thing is just rushed. They're just trying to do it for a money-making purposes. I think that would be a perfect time to have that built in 5-6 days off and just allow that buffer within the season, because one, the season was rushed in the sense that it got started fairly quickly after the last one ended.
And to say the least.
Yes. Well, yes, you know, like, yes. And I get it. They're trying to get the schedule working back on for the next season to start back up in October, November. So they're trying to get it back on track. I get it. Everything just feels rushed, haphazard. They're just making last minute decisions. And I get everything's a money-making process here, but I almost wish they just did away with the All-Star game, just had the break, and then that would give the players rest because they are playing a lot of games in a short amount of time. And then as we're going to see in the second half of the season, all these postponed games are going to come into play here, and who knows where they're going to fit them in. So we don't even know the second half schedule yet, because there's probably a lot of logistics to work out. So that's
where they'll fit them in. Will they be able to fit them in? Like, yeah, a lot of that is seemingly a mystery. It's like, as soon as these two Hornets games went under today, you saw what Chicago at a game and you saw Denver at a game, right? Which is like on the dates that they were scheduled to play the Hornets. I mean, it's so Chicago added one with Detroit and I can't remember what the matchup that Denver added. Yeah. It doesn't matter. Cleveland? But like maybe it does. Honestly, it almost doesn't even matter, but it's like, yeah, like it is like AAU style. You know, then adding, I think I saw Lazarus Jackson tweet that out this afternoon with regards to the Pistons. And I thought it was funny and applicable here, but yeah, like it's been of all of the like news breaking tweets that I think I've ever had, I've gotten from Woj, from Shams or whomever, any of these other, you know, insiders with the NBA, the ones like updating on like what the dunk contest is going to be like for the All-Star break this year. It's like, God, I don't care. I'm not going to watch this. Like it's one thing. Like I thought it would have been a great idea to just honor the All-Stars, right? Still have All-Stars, still name them.
Yeah.
Of course you should have that, but playing the game, I mean, none of this makes, it makes all the sense in the world. And it makes none of the sense in the world to the point. Like, I get it. If you're going to play over 1,000 NBA games this year, you're going to try to play over 1,000 NBA games this year. It's like, what's one more game, right? Except for the fact that you're bringing in players from
multiple
all
teams.
Parts of the just disparate locations all over the country from multiple teams to play in an exhibition game that doesn't matter at all outside of, I guess, like whatever TV revenue it can generate. Yeah, I don't know. It's like, it's not a great look, but I mean, they're going to continue to do it and just power through, I guess. Yeah. But
and a lot of the players are speaking out against it. Like, you know, they don't think that this is the right move to make, Brian.
But, LeBron James, De'Aaron Fox, all of those guys. Yeah. I mean, like if LeBron says it, it carries like a little extra weight probably too. But, you know, everyone's thinking it. Like, who the hell would want to play in this game? Seriously.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not even like really like who is eager to the first break that you've had in months amidst the plague, who is eager to go hop in a jet, get tested a bunch of times, maybe bring your family with you so you can go to Atlanta and play in a, you know, a made for TV event that literally doesn't matter at all. Like has no relevance to like, you know, the day-to-day operations of the leagues outside of like, I guess, whatever revenue it is set to generate. So
I guess the only players that could be like wanting to play in this game could be like first time All-Star players.
Even then it's like, give me the honor, but I don't need to go. Like I can play these dudes and pick up next off season. Like, you know, it's a bummer. Yeah. Like if you're Jaylen Brown and you're going to make the All-Star roster for the first time, you're having a kick-ass season. It's like, yeah, hell yeah. You should want to play in an All-Star game, but like, given the circumstance, no. Like, why the hell would you want to do this, you know?
Like, Jaylen Brown, do you remember your first All-Star game? Well, I was nominated. We didn't play, but I was nominated to play. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And I hope for Mike Conley, he gets his first All-Star nod this season as well. The Jazz are just killing it this season. In terms of getting three All-Stars from that team, in terms of Gobert and Mitchell and Conley, I hope he does make it. It's just so hard sometimes to see three All-Stars from a singular team, but I think you can make the case because the Jazz are first in the West. Like I feel like that's a case to be made, and I feel bad for players like Mike Conley if he does make it for the first time. I think they're going on with this game. I'm speaking as if it's not happening. It's happening, but in my mind,
like they're going to move heaven and earth to make this thing happen. Yeah, I mean, I think Conley. I mean, he's missed a few games now, but you know, I think he's been their second best player this year, right? I mean, like, that's not even a knock on Donovan Mitchell, who is awesome. You know, I think Gobert has been their best player. And if you want to have a debate between who's been better between Conley or Mitchell, like, it probably depends on what sort of criteria or stats you're looking at. They're both really, really good. I hope Conley makes it too. Not for the wonderful opportunity of being flown into Atlanta during the freaking pandemic, but just because like he's been in the NBA for 15 years, he's been awesome. He's been playing at All-Star level this year and for a while now. And the Jazz are awesome. I watched them beat up on it was a pretty close game with the Sixers last night, and Embiid didn't play in that game, but yeah, it's just one of those games. Even without Conley, Utah's scary. Clarkson got hot.
Clarkson surprised me in terms of just his impact with that team. That whole team up and down the roster, like they've got depth. And I've always said that they don't have like a top end talent, but they've got plenty of depth on that team.
They've got a bunch of like B plus, like to A minus maybe shot creators, you know, Conley, Mitchell, Clarkson, Bogdanovich. Ingles. They've got Ingles. They've got snipers and playmakers everywhere. And Gobert makes them functional defensively in favor. Like they have a good bench, you know, Favors is a great backup, is a really solid backup center. Clarkson's, you know, in the race for, he leads the league in bench scoring, which probably makes him the front runner for the Sixth Man of the Year award, or in, you know, certainly in contention for that. He's doing it efficiently. And then you and I both like this player a lot, but Royce O'Neal is just like a stud 3-and-D guy that guards every position, snipes threes, and has like a pretty good like catch and go game, and can pass a little bit on the move too. Like, yeah, like I still like both of the LA teams above them, but they're awesome. They're really good. They're a threat to win the title this year. Yeah. They're legit. They are.
Yeah. Just put Royce O'Neal in the corner and just have people drive and kick, and he's going to knock those down.
Yeah. 43% on threes this year. He's just sniping.
Let's get to some listener questions. I think we mentioned Div's name in this podcast so far, but Div sent in a question. If we assume that LaMelo and Hayward are foundational parts of this team moving forward, which current rotation player do we think fits best with those two, and which rotation player are you concerned may not fit as well moving forward? So I think the most obvious piece, and I think I mentioned this when Div was on the podcast, is Miles Bridges. You know, looking at the numbers, in terms of like the net with all those three on the court, LaMelo, Miles, and Gordon, hasn't been that great. But if you put Gordon and Miles on there, been really good. LaMelo and Miles, those net numbers have been very good. With the lack of a true rim runner that we have on this team and that vertical lob threat, Miles brings that from the forward position. I think you even kind of mentioned that on the last podcast. Like those are the types of players that you need, especially with LaMelo. Any player that can dive and cut into the teeth of the defense, that's going to create problems for the opponents. And Miles is doing that. When LaMelo and Miles are out there on the court, it puts a ton of pressure on the rim. That is definitely supported by the numbers there. And then I think if you draw the defense into the paint, it allows for opportunities elsewhere, you know, on the outside. So, and if we're just thinking of like prototypes, like I just mentioned, the fit next to Melo and Hayward, you do want good rim runners. You do want good, you know, screen setters and players that can knock down an open three. Now, Miles Bridges isn't all three of those things, but right now he's doing a good job of putting pressure in the paint, putting pressure on the rim, and he's got that vertical lob threat that is perfect for LaMelo's game. So that's the one player that really has stuck out to me in terms of just the fit with those two especially.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy. Hard to imagine this too, but Miles is still just 22. I know he turns 23 in March, but like he's still really young. He still should be getting better. I think he's had an awesome season. You know, you certainly want corner three-point shooters around LaMelo. 15% of his shots this year have been from the corners, and he shot a nice number on those looks. He's been less good from above the break. No surprise there. That's sort of like the general trend for the entire league, and that's also fits with Miles for his entire career since he entered the league in 2018. He's shooting 70% at the rim. He's obviously been a wonderful lob piece for LaMelo, either on the pick and roll, little stagger looks that they like to run with those two guys, or in transition, those guys are, you know, LaMelo and Miles are, it's one of the most fun tandems in the league. And I even think Bridges like playmaking has been, I think like really nice this season. I think his short roll passing has been valuable and has been impactful. I think some of his post passing has been good. I think there have been flashes of open court playmaking. He had a really nice, like crossover left to right, plus a right-handed little like floating layup finish and a foul against San Antonio, or that he went over the top of Pirtle, who's blocking everything at the rim right now, aside from that. So, I think Miles can be a little scattershot defensively in terms of like help assignments and stuff, but his athleticism is real, and he's so strong. He can guard a variety of position types, and he can create some events defensively too, but there are gaps and missed assignments as well. Yeah. I say all of that to say that I think PJ is still probably the best fit with these guys. Yes, he does not give you that like vertical lob threat that Miles does. And, you know, that is important with LaMelo. There's no denying that. Those are just Charlotte gets X number of free points with that setup every game, right? Like you can already mark down 2 to 4 points for Charlotte just because of the LaMelo and Miles vertical connection. But and PJ has struggled this season. We talked about this with Spencer and Div last week, right? Like this has been, unfortunately for PJ in terms of scoring, he is, you know, his shot chart is a little weird this year compared to how it was just pristine and perfect last year. Everything at the rim wore a three, and he shot, you know, pretty good numbers on three in part because he was so good from the corners. And, you know, the post-up efficiency has not been as good this season. The rim run efficiency has not been as good. You know, we've seen some games where he's really struggled to finish at the rim. But PJ can do so many things on the basketball court. And I'm trying not to let this like 20 to 25 game sample where he's been up and down and has not been at his best finishing and scoring offensively, like completely push away everything that I thought from him during his second season at Kentucky and during his rookie season with the Hornets. When like, I still think PJ is a guy that should start in the NBA and can be a damn good role player for a decade. He's a pick and pop threat that pairs really well with LaMelo too. He can post switches that pairs well with pick and roll with LaMelo. He's a good corner 3-point shooter. That too is a good piece. He can play make as well too. I know he's had some inconsistencies this year, but he can basically do everything on the court when he's like going right. And he's limited athletically because he's not super explosive. Like we always say in this pod, he plays to the level of the rim. He's not like an above the rim player. And this season, he's probably hasn't been quite there. Probably a little more ground bound than we would probably like to see PJ look. But I would still say he's the best fit long term with that group going forward. Can play the four, can play the five. I mean, I know Bridges has versatility between the 3, 4, and 5 too. But I'm still going to make the case for PJ. He should still be a very good rotation piece for a long time in the NBA. And his ability to stretch and pass, I think is our real weapons, and I think fit with LaMelo and Hayward. And as we've discussed on this pod before too, like those guys, Hayward and LaMelo, they're tethered together for the next 4 years because that's the extent of Hayward's contract and that's the extent of LaMelo's rookie contract. It's going really well right now. We'll see what that looks like, you know, with Hayward in a couple of years. I think you could make a case for a couple of other guys on the roster. Cause if you're looking at that 4-year window, like, you know, maybe Cody Zeller, you know, if you wanted to make the case maybe someone wants to make the case for Rozier. I don't feel particularly inspired to do that. You know, there's maybe some sort of like wacky off the wall case for Monk to be in this conversation as well. But I really think it does come down to Bridges or PJ and I'll go Washington.
I lean a little bit Bridges, but I think PJ can learn a lot from Miles. Like Miles to me had some ups and downs in his sophomore season and he's turned it around this year. So I think a lot of what struggles that PJ is having could be mental. Like he's missing a lot of bunnies at the rim and you're just like, is this getting in your head after everyone that you miss? You're just overthinking it because you were just, that is something that's always been a part of his game, especially when he was at Kentucky. So I think that this is just like a learning experience for PJ. I am not by any means like overly concerned, but I think anyone would say that this season for PJ has not gone up to the standards that I think that most fans would want out of him. The second part of this question, who are you most concerned that's a rotation player that would not fit well with these two? Now I'm looking up and down the roster. I mean, there's not like one that like sticks out in my mind that like, I'm just like overly concerned that won't fit with LaMelo or Gordon. I do think LaMelo and Gordon are very good facilitators. That's part of their game. They can make players look better than they really are. I guess you can say Biz because he is somewhat of a rotational player, but the good news is, if you want to call it good news, he's a free agent at the end of this year. So it may not be something that the organization will have to stress too much about, you know, moving forward. But like I said, I think LaMelo has made Biz a better player. I think Biz at times has looked better than he really is. Now, granted, he actually, to me, Biz, has impressed with the way that he's caught the ball this year. He's even impressed me in the way that he's played out of the short role at times. But, I mean, he clearly clogs the lane. He doesn't offer much in terms of spacing. And while he can catch a lob every now and then, like, that's not something that I just, like, would want to rely on. So, I don't know. I don't know how to answer that second part of the question. One, because Biz won't be on this team next season unless we re-sign him, which I don't think that's the route they're going to take. I mean, is there a play on this roster that you're just like, okay, this guy does not mesh well with LaMelo. This guy does not mesh well.
Luckily, this is like the value of the Hornets lucking into the number three pick and seemingly really hit on something with LaMelo Ball is he has to get so much better in so many different things, but he's a 6'7" primary creator, right? Like, that checks so many boxes. That makes team building so much more interesting and maybe more challenging in some ways, but as like on like a baseline level of like building out a roster, at least like making a competent roster, whether it's like a title contending team, that's where I think the real challenges lie. But building something like good and semi-sustainable around him should be fun. I mean, it's going to be a challenge, no doubt, but like, it just, the possibilities are so much easier now than when you're still searching in the dark for a LaMelo Ball, right? And hoping you get the number one pick this year so you can draft Cade Cunningham, right? Or draft and get the number three pick and draft Jalen Suggs or whatever. The one guy, I'll say this, like, I think Devontae and LaMelo have had some really nice moments together this season. Some of those lineups with those two have been pretty good this year as well, as we've discussed on this podcast. But if you have LaMelo and you have Hayward, so you've got some playmaking, you've got some shooting, you've got some usage, you've got some creation, but you really need a little more defense. You maybe need a guy that can really run around and shoot threes or attack a closeout, whatever. Just like the skills that you would be looking for at that next off-ball guard. I don't know if Devontae Graham checks all of those boxes. You would want a better defender. You would want a better on-ball point of attack defender to pair with LaMelo and to pair with Gordon Hayward. You would want someone that could really pressure the rim a la Malik Monk, right? And be able to drive from 25 feet out. Devontae Graham doesn't do that. Maybe you would want someone that can run around screens and bomb threes. And Devontae can do that. So that's why I'm not saying this can't work. And as we've talked about so many times, even before LaMelo was on this roster, like Devontae's, ultimately, like the hope is probably for him to turn into your sixth man stud. But I don't know. There's already some those jobs are pretty fluid. You know what I mean? I mean, you can have some guys that can be a franchise backup. You can have your Monte Morris or you can have your Fred VanVleet, although he's gotten so good that he's like he's a starter, an integral part of what Toronto's, doing going forward, obviously, in this year too. But maybe Devontae, as far as like the actual rotation pieces,
right,
maybe the one that's like, that's like the least clean fit. And then, I don't know. It's like Zeller is such a great fit, but the health concerns and like the age timeline aspects, maybe you want to make a case for that too. You can almost argue Zeller on both sides of this hypothetical.
Yeah. I guess a good way of putting the Devontae thing, like, I don't necessarily think it's a bad fit with those two, but I think there's better ways to maximize the roster.
Exactly.
That's probably the best way to put it.
There's some overlap and there's some diminishing returns, right?
Yeah.
And so if you're thinking about, if you have a finite amount of resources, well, like, what's the best way to allocate them?
Yeah.
We'll see. Devontae is he's a free agent this summer. So there's some this offseason for Charlotte is going to be a little interesting with the free agency of Zeller, Monk, Devontae Graham. Rozier will effectively become an expiring contract as this free agency approaches in 2022. Like, there's a, Biz is a free agent. There's a lot of stuff to address going forward.
And I think the thing is with Devontae, like, if his role is best suited coming off the bench, then maybe his minutes aren't directly tied to Hayward and LaMelo as much. Obviously, there's staggering that goes on. But You bring up Terry Rozier, and the next listener asks a question, is Terry more valuable long-term as a cornerstone piece or a trade chip this year to get Mobley? I say keep him, but just a topic for conversation. So this is a very good question. This was a question or a topic that I was going to bring up regardless at some point. And I think we have to have this discussion somewhat soon. But before we get into whether or not we think he's valuable for this team or valuable as a trade chip, I just want to hit upon like Rozier. Like, he's been so good this year. He's been better than last season, especially recently. In the last seven games, he's been averaging 27 points, shooting 55% on catch and shoot three-pointers, 38% on pull-up three-pointers. He's been a real asset to this team on both ends of the court. He's been a pesky on-ball three-quarter court defender. He's just lighting it up offensively. He's been much more aggressive and more decisive, you know, in his decision making. And I even mentioned this, I believe, on Twitter the other day. Like, the thing that stuck out to me last season with Terry Rozier, outside of the good catch and shoot numbers, was the fact whenever he snaked pick and rolls, he was very indecisive. It's almost like he kept the defender on his back and did not have a plan in place. Now, when he's snaking pick and rolls, he's being more decisive. He's being aggressive. He's attacking the rim. We've seen him hit some shots high off the glass over, you know, bigs. And something that I mentioned about a week and a half ago, I think when I did a solo pod, but he's been a factor in the pull-up mid-range game as well. And that just gives another added element to his game. This is like the most confident that I've seen him. And he's a confident player as it is, but this is the most confident that I've seen Rozier since he was acquired by the Hornets a couple summers ago. And I guess to kind of go back to the question, I think that's what makes it so hard to determine if he's a better trade piece or a staple, because he has been good and he's relatively young and he's been an impact player on this team. What have you seen so far from Terry Rozier this season before we kind of touch upon the question here?
Yeah, I have a couple thoughts. One is, I think you're mentioning Terry and his ability to snake screens. I still find myself watching games and occasionally getting frustrated because sometimes those things go, they just die on the vine. I think with Rozier, his pick and roll activity, a lot of it depends on where the screen is and how it's been set up. I like Rozier more as like a side handoff pick and roll guy, right? Or you run him off a down screen and then the guy who sets the off ball screen goes and dives to the hoop, right? I sort of like Terry more in those, as opposed to just like his shot clock running down, give Terry the ball from at 26 feet and run a ball. You know, I'd rather have LaMelo or Devontae or Gordon Hayward probably maybe doing those things. His catch and shoot game has been ridiculous this season. You mentioned that, Richie, but 79%, 79% effective shooting on half court catch and shoot looks this season. That's in the 98th percentile in the NBA. On pull-up shooting in the half court, 53.5% effective shooting. That's in the 83rd percentile on a ton of volume. Terry Rozier, among NBA players with at least 100 spot-up possessions, just ahead of Donovan Mitchell for number one in the NBA this season in efficiency on spot-up possessions. Funny enough, Nick Batum is number three amongst this group, followed by Joe Harris and Malik Beasley. But that's the top five. And that'll change. Like, Donovan Mitchell was ahead of Terry before they played against Philadelphia last night. But the point is, he has shot the ball outstandingly well off the catch, just absolutely breathing fire. Malik Monk's been great off the catch this season too. He's about 62% on catch and shoot threes for Monk this year, which will come down eventually, but for now is pretty fun. Thinking elsewhere about Terry, you mentioned his point of attack defense. We talked about that a little bit last week. You know, I still think he messes up a lot on defense. Like, I still think he misses rotations. I still don't think he's like a great playmaker for others. Anytime he creates off the pick and roll, like, it's to get to his shot, and that's okay. Like, this team for right now, they need people to take shots, but like, he's not an A1 creator by any means. He sort of tops out, in my opinion, as a secondary creator. And to his credit, he sort of bought into that. I think that was one of the things before he arrived in Charlotte from Boston, where I was sort of worried of like, oh man, does he want to like play with the ball? And then Devontae started playing so well, where it was like, will Terry be okay with this secondary offensive role? And like, yeah, he is. Like, he's fine to run around and bang threes. And JB, especially on after timeout looks, like, really leverages Rozier's movement shooting, right? Like a lot, so many of those after timeouts designs that Borrego draws up, they involve Rozier coming off a screen or coming off throwback action or something like that to look for a good shot. So Charlotte is really like, you know, putting the pedal to the metal with what Rozier can do as a shooter right now, both perhaps because like it helps them, I guess, win games in the interim. And then, I mean, I don't think this is why they're doing it, but if you wanted to showcase Terry Rozier as like a sniper, and like a real threat running around screens, as which can be a benefit to basically any offense in the NBA, Charlotte's probably done a pretty good job of that indirectly. You know, again, I don't love him as a creator because he's not like a great passer a la certainly LaMelo, maybe not even, you know, Monk or Devontae. And again, I think he has gaps defensively as a team and help defender. But he gets steals. And you mentioned his point of attack defense and his willingness to really guard, you know, 70 feet, 80 feet of real estate can be a value to the Hornets. So, and like, ultimately, man, like I just can't believe how much return they've gotten on this deal already. Like I was not really in favor of this. I give Spencer a lot of credit for at least seeing the forest through the trees as to like why Charlotte maybe wanted to do this beyond just getting something as opposed to nothing with Kemba leaving. For me, it was really easy to see the value with the Hayward signing, even if I didn't necessarily agree with it. The Rozier transaction was more of a challenge, but that's why, I mean, Spencer was all over that when this thing happened, 2 summers ago. So yeah, I as far as like how he fits, you know, long-term, I have some thoughts, but what do you think, Richie, what's the way to maximize the remainder of the Terry Rozier experience in Charlotte?
Yeah. So I do think when it comes to realistic options, Rozier could probably be Charlotte's best trade piece. And just in terms of who they could trade and what they could get back. Now, obviously, LaMelo Ball will get you back more than Rozier, but
yeah,
we're not trading LaMelo.
Realistic trade pieces. Yes, he's probably the best thing they have available. Yes. Yeah, probably.
I mean, like, you know, you can throw Cody Zeller into there, but right now, yes. Terry Rozier, the way that he's playing, he's going to be giving the Hornets the most in return. Now, his salary, you know, $19 million is a little tricky to work with. It makes it difficult in terms of maybe getting something in value of return. But I'm assuming if you're trading Terry Rozier, it's probably going to be going to a contender. Like a contender would love to have this guy on their team. So the question states, you know, a trade chip to get Mobley. I don't think anybody in the upper tier or the lower tier, however you want to look at it, the lower tier of the lottery, upper tier of the lottery, wants somebody like Terry Rozier. They're going to just take their chances on Mobley, I would assume.
Yeah, they should. Evan Mobley is awesome.
Yeah.
He's the number two prospect in this draft by a lot. I mean, he would be such a great fit with Charlotte. He's like a perfect fit with LaMelo in so many different ways. But as much fun as Charlotte's start to the season has been, I think they've played themselves out of the hypothetical Evan Mobley. The only case I could maybe see this happening would be Golden State is so desperate, right? Like Golden State's they're gunning for the playoffs right now. And they're what, 20th in offense. They're like something like that. Even though Steph has been amazing. Steph's like, you know, shooting 50, 40, 90. Right. Mm-hmm. But maybe, you know, they don't have Klay Thompson. Maybe they would want another shooter. I mean, Rozier doesn't really help out any of their like, you know, creation concerns that much. But maybe with Draymond and again, I don't even know like the package that Golden State would offer. But Golden State has the Minnesota pick, right? It's top three protected for 2021. And then I believe it's unprotected for 2022. So that pick maybe even like that pick is crazy. That's like one of the biggest like floating assets right now. Like Minnesota needs that pick.
Yes.
You see how much of a mess they are this season. And I mean, Anthony Edwards looked awesome against Charlotte the other night. I think he's going to be a good pro. I'm excited for the Anthony Edwards experience, but like they need to, I know they got D'Angelo Russell. I'm not a huge D'Lo guy to begin with. But if they lose that pick, you know, if that pick falls fourth, You know, they lose out to draft Jalen Suggs, who's from Minnesota, or Jonathan Kuminga, you know, whomever. So that was maybe the one thought, like, could you, I'm not saying this is going to happen, but Golden State is the one sort of like wild card, you know, pseudo playoff team that would maybe be interested in someone like Rozier. But I don't anticipate that happening. I don't anticipate Charlotte moving Terry Rozier. No. If the question is, what's the best way to like maximize Terry Rozier? Yeah, it would be to trade. If you could get a legit package, like if you could get a good first round pick for Terry, then that's a good bit of business. Cause then that's connected to the Kemba transaction, right? Is it not? You know, it's like then all of a sudden you would end up getting a first round pick or some package of assets indirectly for Kemba. If you wanted to even think about it like that. So I don't foresee that happening, to be clear.
Yeah, it's sometimes hard to kind of imagine his value and what it would get in return, knowing full well that I don't think Charlotte is going to entertain any kind of trade involving Rozier, considering where they're at in the standings in the East. I think they're going to stand pat and hold on to him, even though it may be the savvy thing to do in terms of maybe trying to flip him for something. And that's a good point about the Golden State pick. Well, I guess it's technically the Minnesota pick. If it falls below 3, that would be a contending team or a playoff team that's trying to push for it, that also has a high-ish pick there. So that actually ties...
Logistically, like, I'm not sure all of that would even work, but that was just the one in my head that I was thinking of. I'm not sure the feasibility of that on a couple of different levels, but that was the one thing that was sort of rattling around in my head as a possibility, mate, I guess.
Yeah, and I don't think Charlotte would necessarily entertain it. Like, I don't think they're out there seeking trades for Rozier, and I'm not sure Golden State would do it. But that's a very interesting kind of trade partner there. And this ties to our last question of the podcast from AJ Shannon. Should the Hornets make a trade? And you know, whether it's Rozier or whether it's, you know, anyone else on the roster. If so, what position and who on the roster is available? Well, first off, the most obvious position of need, and we've talked about this before, is center. Zeller is really the only competent true center on the roster. But this also gets into the question, and I think we should discuss this from the Hornets' point of view. Should they be buyers? Should they be sellers? Or should they just sit tight? Because I can see whenever you have Michael Jordan in the front office, and maybe he's changed his ways over the course of the last year and a half, but that would be the short-sighted move to be a buyer in this situation. There's no move out there that's going to get this team over the hump to make it past the first round of the playoffs if they do make the playoffs. So that would be mortgaging the future just to say, hey, we made it to the second round of the playoffs. I just don't even know if there's a move that exists. But I could see the Hornets trying to be buyers in a situation and in a season like this. Sellers, to Brian's point, you know, I asked myself, could that be the way to do this? Like, that would be the savvy move, to go trade Rozier for something in return, even though that doesn't, you know, necessarily make a ton of sense in terms of the direction with the team right now and where they're at in the standings in the East. I think all things that we've kind of gathered, this team is pushing to win, pushing for the playoffs. So that's why I think, you know, the best of both worlds is just to stand pat. I mean, you aren't selling off a piece for future assets, and you're not going out to try to get a quick fix. I think riding it out with this roster for this season is probably the best way to go. And if I had to put money on it, Brian, I think this is the route that the, you know, the Charlotte organization will take in the end. So do you think the Hornets should make a trade at all, Brian? And if so, will it be more of the buyer type or more of the seller type?
I mean, I know what I would like for them to do. And you touched on some of those things, in part because, like, I assume they would be sort of like, you know, for lack of a better term, tanking this year. And so they would be in line to get another high draft pick. And maybe that will still happen. Like, but right now, you know, they're 6 in the East. And even if they fall some, you know, they're still in the playoff picture, the play-in scenario or whatever. So it's just like, if because they decided to go so hard, they added Hayward and they really decided to go into like, we're going to win now sort of mode, or win as much as we can now mode. It makes me think like that the thinking and from the front office or the top down would want to make another buyer trade, right? Would want to add something to the roster to make them a little bit stronger. Well, what be it, you know, on the margins or something, you know, more substantial. But my thought would be, look, because you sort of punted on like getting a high pick this year, or at least for the time being you have, that opportunity cost could be sunk already. Like, don't then like flush more assets, right? You know what I mean? Like, that would be the compromise I would be sort of interested in of working of like, look, if we're going to go for it, then let's play it out with this group here without really like, you know, kicking away any future asset. You know what I mean? Like, we've already dropped out of some of our 2021 cap space to add Hayward this year, and that's been a good move. So let's keep pushing. Let's just keep going in that direction. I think it's interesting too, because it's hard to think of like who's tradable on this roster. If you're trying, let's say you're trying to make, as we discussed with Div and Spencer last week, let's say you're trying to make, if you're trying to make just a small add, let's say you just want to add a backup center to this rotation, right? What are you going to move to do that? Like, realistically, like, what's the, like, I guess you could try to sign a free agent. Like, guess what? Michael Kidd-Gilchrist Jr. is still around. Like, would you be interested in signing MKG? He doesn't add that sort of like vertical threat to the roster, but I think Charlotte's roster sits at 14 and they're you know, maybe you could just try to go in and add, add MKG. I believe they're what, a couple million under the cap. But if you were going to trade, like what like small contract would you use to go add like Nerlens Noel or to add Kem Birch or to try to get, you know, Robert Williams from Boston? I don't think that's a possibility either. Like, you'd have to probably use some draft capital to even grease the wheels, right? But like beyond that, what's the, if you needed to send a salary out, what's the salary? Is it Cody Martin? Is it Biz? Like, is it basically like, is it Biz? I don't think that's what you would use. Or is it one of these guys you drafted the last couple of years that this front office drafted that you have bird rights on, you know? Now, I guess maybe that's Malik Monk, but I don't think that would be the best use of him at all. Like, in right now you're seeing him be, I think, a fairly important piece to their rotation, even when Devontae Graham comes back. So just like, I don't know. It's not like they couldn't do it. It's just, it's hard to see them parting ways with several of these guys that they have that are even though like, the bottom end of this roster that are all cheap guys that are maybe rotation players, but it's just like, I don't know. I mean, I guess they could trade one of the Martins. I guess they could, you know,
do people
like,
view the Martins out there? Do people view the Martins as somebody that's of value?
That's why you would have to use like some sort of draft capital. You know what I mean? To go to New York and say like one of the Martins plus this second round pick for, you know, a rental of Nerlens Noel, which like, I don't think that's like, I don't know if that's something they want to pursue or should pursue, but that's the kind of move that I would be thinking, like the lines that I would be thinking along.
Now Nerlens makes $5 million and Malik makes 5.3. I mean, I don't know if you would do a straight up trade like that. Like that would be worth it in the end. I guess maybe, but I would say no.
I mean, I would not. I would absolutely not do that. And I'd like to see how PJ finishes the season out too. Like maybe he's given you some minutes at the center. Let's see him maybe play a little bit better, hopefully. But you're probably not moving Biz for all of the, you know, the chemistry and leadership reasons that we talk about on the podcast. And I don't know if you want to move any of these draft picks from the last 4 years either. Like I don't. And like that's the roster, you know, like that's it. So I'm just not sure that exists. I mean, maybe Vernon Carey Jr. plays well in the bubble and you try to, I mean, again, he's not going to give you that vertical threat that this team probably needs along the front line. And another guy that could run pick and roll and catch lobs from LaMelo and give you some rim protection. But during down in the bubble in 3 G League games, Vernon Carey Jr. is averaging 25-10 on 60% shooting, including 67% on twos. I mean, he's not like a lob guy and he's not like a rim protector and he's not shooting three still. So maybe you try him, maybe you try Nick Richards, you know, before you would even consider any of these sorts of scenarios. Charlotte has options, which is nice. Just sort of surveying things. I mean, there's a couple of scenarios I think you can talk yourself into, but at the moment, I'm not finding any of them like particularly appealing. Yes, I'd love to have another front court piece on this roster. But I don't want to. There's nothing I'm looking up and down and saying like, I either want to give that up if I'm Charlotte, or I like think that they would consider giving it up, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. I mean, you look at the roster and, you know, matching salaries and stuff like that. The bottom of the roster in terms of the salary cap sheet, Richards, Carey Jr., Caleb Martin, Jalen McDaniels, Cody Martin, those types of players aren't necessarily going to bring a ton back in return. And I keep going back to Malik Monk. Like, that's that one player that kind of fits the low-ish salary and could potentially bring back a player that could be an impact. But I still don't think it'd be worthwhile in the end. And like I said before, I think you just ride it out with this roster. They are overperforming in my eyes, and just see how far they can make it this season, and just, yeah, you know, appreciate the development, appreciate the ride that they're on right now. So that's kind of how I would wrap up this episode, guys. We'd love to hear what you guys think in terms of what the Hornets should do and how they should approach the trade deadline. We appreciate you guys. Thanks again for listening to another Buzz Beat. If you're listening right now and haven't given us a review on Apple Podcasts, we'd appreciate it if you could just scroll down on your phone, on our page, hit the 5 stars. It takes all of 30 seconds to do. For Brian, I am Richie. We'll see you guys next time.